As Jenny said, this is the second time we have had a panel on this topic of my journey with the Bible, or the Bible and me, or whatever we want to call it. And it's different from a sermon, because what these people are talking about is not something that they've done study in or have researched. It's about themselves and their journey. So thank you, panelees, for... well, you can do research as well, but... and it's a way of getting to know each other a little better. You might not agree with them, you might, but maybe it'll cause you to reflect on things in your journey as well. If you can't hear, will you wave your hand, please? So, Bobby, you are first off the rank. So... Question one is, when did you first encounter the Bible and how did you respond to it back then?
Me sitting here doesn't mean to say I'm going to answer every question first, I have to point out.
No, we'll share.
When I was a child, I used to draw very well and I used to send pictures to magazines, children's pages, and get prizes for them. And in those days, incredibly, they used to publish your address with your name. And one day in the mail, there turned up a little book for me, and it was the Gospel of Luke. Now, my parents didn't regularly read the Bible, I have to say. We lived on a farm. We never went to church. And this Gospel of Luke turned up out of the blue. And I read it, or I tried to read it. It was King James Version. I was about 7. I think I've still got it somewhere. And ever since then, the Gospel of Luke has always been my favourite gospel, even though in those days I couldn't understand much about it at all.
I first encountered the Bible through going to Sunday school, probably from about age 6 or 7. They got us early in those days, through the Baptist church that I went to. But I have to say that the most profound and informative way that I learnt about the Bible was through a 10-volume series of books called The Bible Story by Uncle Arthur, the original Uncle Arthur, Arthur S. Maxwell. I don't know if... I did some research.
Yeah, that's fine, that's good.
it was that kind of writing. Anyone remember those? It was a 10-volume series, and I had my parents bought them for me probably when I was about 9 or 10. 10 volumes, the whole story as paraphrased by, or selected stories by Arthur S. Maxwell, and I would have read those 10 volumes at least a dozen times in my childhood. So, and the really special thing about this series was that they were commissioned by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they decided that the primary way they were going to communicate was through pictures. So although the words came from the KJV, not the KJB, they commissioned some fantastic artists, and in particular one guy called Russell Harlan, who just painted the most beautiful, beautiful pictures. And one of the tunes that we sing in church, Faithful and True, the image that I have from that comes from a drawing by, I don't know if it was Russell Harlan or Kenneth Anderson, one of the other painters, of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Really kind of imprinted in my brain just these images of God working his way through history. So I just wanted to thank Uncle Arthur because I learnt more about the Bible from those books than anything else, at least for the first half of my life.
Well, like Bobby, I grew up in a farm at Bolgart. It was at the end of a road, and then there was Julimar State Forest, and the first 12 years, that nature was the first Bible for me. And we did go to church. Fortunately, it was just once a month because the minister had to do lots of other little churches around 2J, Kalingari, Wongan, Yerikoin. And so in those early days, it was mainly the hymn book and the Australian prayer book. But like I say... this really comes second to me because growing up on a farm, you just know the rhythm of life and the seasons that are just, you're a part of it and you work with the seasons. And Mum always said that I was Dad's right-hand man, and so if we weren't at school, I was there with Dad. And so you knew that after we'd been to Safety Bay or Rottnest for the summer break, things just started again. There were, you put the rams in, and when the first rains came, there would be, you would seed. The 1st of June, there would be the first of hundreds of merino lambs, and then you would, then there would be shearing, which was a huge event, and then there was the harvest, and so it just revolved around the seasons rather than the months. And that was and has always been a way that God has spoken to me. When I was 12, I was confirmed in St. Philip's Church, which is this little isolated church on the road between 2J and Bolgart. And my grandparents did give me a Bible, but a book that Hughie McGuinness, the minister who confirmed me, that completely changed my life from this isolated farm environment to, and it was called The Tribes of Papua New Guinea. And to this day, that book has just been a huge influence on where I live, where I work, at a school with 45 different nationalities. Yeah, so that's the beginning of my journey.
No, you can start.
We're going to rotate the beginning. Well, actually, no, I think, Bobby, you can answer this one first again, and then you don't have to again.
All right. Otherwise, you won't get a word anyways.
Yeah. That wasn't what I thought for. Okay, so you've talked about first encounters, first responses. How has that response or attitude changed over time? Were there particular turning points, or did things just evolve as life went on?
Well, one of the things was, of course, I didn't understand the Gospel of Luke in King James Version. Some years later, we moved into town and started going to church, and my mother bought me a Bible, which was also a King James Bible. Didn't understand that well either. Later on, got an RSV, which was an awful lot better. The thing that really, there were two things, I suppose. One was when I was 12, we went to see the movie Ben-Hur, and as my husband reminded me last night, I actually became a believer through that movie. The sight of Christ, you know, preaching and the crucifixion. I'd actually not believed before, so I have to say that we used to get Bible stories from an aunt of mine who was a missionary in Tanzania, and I actually went so far as to say I don't believe any of this. I remember one time scoffing at the story of the man who was brought down through the ceiling. They made a hole in the roof and brought the man down on the bed so that Christ would heal him, and I said, how could anybody do that? Not knowing much about the kind of houses they had in those places. Anyway, I saw this film and it was very real to me, and I believed it, even though the acting now is appalling whenever I see it. But, you know, at that time, at 12 years of age, being fairly unsophisticated. However, I didn't become a Christian till I was in New Zealand with a Presbyterian church there. The thing that really struck me after I became a Christian was that I started understanding the Bible. Before that, I could read it and go in one ear and out the other. I actually used to read it at one period in my life before I became a Christian. I used to read it every night because I thought you should, and it just didn't make any difference to me at all. When I became a Christian, it started making sense to me.
My church, like many at the time, was a very conservative fundamentalist church, and in the Baptist scene, the Protestant scene, the kinds of basically as a literal interpretation of the Bible, you had the 7-day creation. The sun really did stop when Joshua was beating the crap out of the Amorites. They had a premillennial view of the last days, where God's children would be whisked away in the rapture, and all the baddies would be left behind, you know, the Anglicans and the Catholics. and the rest. Definitely the Catholics, that's right. It took me a long time to recognise that that was what I thought. It's one of the problems with trusting the people who teach you things. You don't give a moment's thought to the fact that you're accepting a teaching. I got to a point where I couldn't continue that particular way of reading the Bible and at the same time conduct rational thinking in every other area of my life. And I realized that doctrines come from people. They're not immutable. If you trust a person, you're more likely to accept their doctrine as true, that people are fallible. And as I grew older and I saw that those people who taught me stuff were fallible people, then I had some disillusionment with what they taught me. And therefore, I made a distinction between what there is to be learnt and the person that teaches it to you. They're not the same thing. So I think my biggest shift in reading the Bible was to no longer accept at face value that what people taught me about it was actually the way it was. I felt like that I had to do my own homework and my own thinking. And the scary bit was the possibility of arriving at a different conclusion from those whom I loved and respected. That was a big shift.
There were significant turning places for me in my life, and people who tried to get me to understand Christianity when I was going through my teenage years completely, I just didn't want them in my life. And they just scared me. They just scared me because, like Bobby, I just didn't understand the Bible. But from that book that Hughie McGinnis gave me, I pretty well daydreamed all my way through high school, and I had a mate, Troy, said, "Fleur, what are you thinking about?" And I said, "Well, I'm actually thinking about when I see the pyramids." And so I was in Canada, and I was with these people that I'd met in Norway earlier on another trip. And they were just going tree planting, because that's what a lot of students do to save for their summer break. And I thought, I want to do that, because to fund my nomadic way of life, I had to go up to Panawanika and drive haul packs for quite a while to save all my money. And I thought, I'm never going to do that again, just this taking away from the earth. And I thought, well, this is my payback to the earth. I'll go and plant lots of trees, which was bloody hard work. Worked as hard as a shearer and had an amazing appetite. So in this group of tree planters amongst the students, there was a group of Christians, and Julie, we'd gone into this little town north in Ontario to get supplies, and Julie, she says, "I'm going to get you a Bible." And she charged into this Catholic church in this isolated town, and she found a New International Version. And so in my tent at night, I would read like crazy. She wanted me to read about all the women of the Bible and their strengths. And so that's what I would do. And in the morning, I'd wake up to the sound of the loon and the moose, and I'd read some more. And then Julie would say, "You know, how'd you go?" And she really made me, I'm not a talker, so she really made me talk about what I'd learnt from the things that I had read. And like Bobby, there was a distinct time, then all of a sudden this Bible is no longer a foreign language. It came alive to me. And even when I went right up into the north, into the Yukon Territory, and I worked with children up there, Indigenous children, I just wanted to devour this the Bible, and I started going to church, and so from then on, that's what happened.
Your turn to go.
Okay.
So, what things do you find tricky or challenging or difficult? And we've got about 3 minutes each. So.
Bobby just told me not to take too long.
I'm aware that that is an absolutely huge question, and also that there's some danger in giving a short version because you may be misunderstood. But let's give it a go, and can I encourage people to carry on the conversation afterwards? This is sort of tip of the iceberg stuff, so...
Stop looking at me, Moyd.
Okay, off you go.
I will be brief. This is a bit like coming out. there are two observations that I've made about the Bible and us over the years. I mean, two of many observations. One is that we're people of the book. And that's what the Muslims call us, people of the book. We almost totally determine how we think, what we do, how we act together from the book. People have written reams and reams and reams in incredible detail on individual verses, whole books written on individual verses on the book. So what would happen if the book was wrong? What would happen if your way of reading that was wrong? There are whole industries based on reading the book in a certain way. People have made their careers on promulgating the book. Our personal lives, our psychological makeup, our whole way of seeing things is based on the book. And if the way that we've read the book is wrong, or was wrong, say, what would we do? I'm shit scared at the thought of it. I don't want to say too much more because perhaps we'll leave room for questions, but the notion God's inspired word is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in the sense that just by saying those words, it gives us some assurance, some confidence that what we read is a trustworthy and reliable way of handling life. And the problem is that it's a prison, because it commits us in many ways to accepting or imputing a level of confidence in what's written that we can't wriggle out of easily in a whole range of areas. Things like, the whole thing of the literal interpretation of Genesis. Did David really exist? What would happen if there wasn't a virgin birth? What happens if there's a more reasonable explanation? And I'm left with this really scary question. What if it wasn't handed down from on high? What if another way of seeing it was that it came from below, and that it's the combined experience of human beings struggling with a real God, with a real Jesus, but with a whole bunch of crap thrown in as well? What if it's that take? And I have to confess that my biggest shift over the last decade is to consider the Bible from that point of view. And I know that that automatically excommunicates me from a whole range of congregations. So it's a big deal for me to say that in public, this is being recorded, and I'm hoping that it's being recorded because I feel like I need to lay it on the line. I really hate the notion of evangelical and liberal. They are such offensive words to me now because they force you to pick, make a choice, when in fact the ineffable, the inexplainable doesn't fit those boundaries. And we could, and thank you, Peter, for starting every single sermon with, I could be wrong, but I've thrown my lot in with this particular way of seeing things. That's my take.
So, Fleur. Fleur, in brief.
Oh, yeah.
No.
No, that
Paul.
Was well done, Paul.
No, just let me clarify for Paul that I wasn't having a go at you at all. Yeah. I thought that was beautifully succinct and honest and clear. So, yeah.
And I'll be in dot point form because I belong to a community with people like Paul that completely pull the Bible apart, and that's great. I love being involved in that. A lot of things I struggle with John 14:7, where it says Jesus is the only way. And when I have Muslim people in my home that say, Fleur, I've got to pray, I just can't think that, they're not praying to God. I just, because they're not praying to through Jesus, I just really struggle with that. And I also really struggle with be yoked. I've always struggled with that because the minister of St. Matt's, where I was going 25 years ago, wouldn't marry David and I. And I just was really sad about that because we just are so... just so compatible and happily married, even though he is not a Christian. And he just loves nature, and he really struggles with a lot of the Bible. And I'm not the person to break all the Bible up for him, but, you know, where it says subdue, you know, he just, all those sort of things. And, so that's me.
Okay. I'll try not to be too long. I'll look at the clock. I read the Bible as a historian because I read lots of history books, and I also read ancient history. And I and Claire all resonate to this. I wonder what the world would have been like if they'd simply lost a few chapters of Genesis and started with chapter 1 and then went to some period after the fall, because the thing that strikes me as a historian about chapters 1 and 2 in Genesis is that they're two completely separate accounts, often incompatible, that people found somewhere, laid side by side, and didn't do anything to try and resolve the differences in them. And I have a problem with that because there's a lot of bits of the Bible like that, and it's basically bad history writing. It is. But on the plus side, when people complain about the Gospels and the fact that they've got different stories in them, I say, if you know anything about oral history, you'll know that every eyewitness tells a different story. So to me, the fact that the four Gospels are so different says that they're real, that they actually are based on real historical accounts by people, because you won't get two people agreeing on the same thing about what was said, when, how it was said, to whom it was said, who was wearing blue and who was wearing white, whatever. So there's my sort of historical take on the Bible. And a lot of it doesn't mean a lot to me, and I don't worry about inerrancy because I don't believe in it. In that sense, you know, it's just not an issue for me. I'm not a theologian. I have never studied any biblical studies. I have no intention of doing so. In contrast to my work, which is, you know, going into theory and arguing against other people's theories, I keep it simple. And the Bible that I've read ever since I came back to Perth in the 70s is the Good News Bible. In fact, my sister gave me a copy of the Good News Bible, which I still got, and I dropped it in the Balga Church of Christ car park one wet night, and it's still got stains all over the bit where she wrote in the front. Belga Church of Christ, I think it was. I used to go there as a youth worker, and they were very hardline conservative. But anyway, I've thought recently maybe I should move to another translation because I'm getting a bit bored with Good News. But the thing about Good News was it actually, when I got it, it was like reading the Bible anew. And now a lot of people say, oh, you know, it's really basic, bad English, bad translation. But it was, a lot of the verses I'd read in RSV, it was just like reading the Bible anew, so it was a great experience. And so at least one of my favourite bits of it is a Good News translation, I think. Yeah.
Thank you, Bobby. Last question, Fleur. Is there a part of the Bible which has particular significance for you and why? And if there isn't, that's fine.
Well, if I've got tough decisions to make, I am always out on my own in nature and God just speaks to me through nature, and I'm sure a lot of other people are like that as well. And I just, even from a young age, I was walking back from the cattle yards with my dad once with a full bottle of a bucket of milk that he had just milked, and the cow, and Dad said, I said to Dad, summer is coming, because I could hear the white-tailed black cockatoos coming over, and they weren't always at the farm. And I struggle that Richard Rohr says that, you know, people came along in December and all the other months are, you know, all the history that we, you know, we think humans think too much of themselves, and they're not in balance with the natural world. And even that, it goes right down to every news report lately. It says when they report on the fires, there's no damage to property or wildlife. And I just think, shit, it's burnt through millions of, or, you know, thousands of acres of bush where millions of animals live in one tree. And I really struggle with that. We're just so focused on ourselves. And I'd like equal portion put on to God's kingdom, all up into when humans came along and thought that we're so important.
I think for me, over the last decade, I've had a renewed appreciation and passion for living as Jesus created role models for us. I don't think I've seen a greater need for people to be informed by how Jesus lived and what he taught as now. Jesus went against the evolutionary grain. He didn't talk about altruism. His notion of love transcends self-interest. It's not just the evolutionary thing of, I'll love you because in the long run it helps me. That's the thing that's radically different in Jesus' teaching. And I see the world going to hell in a handbasket in some ways, I'm just even more kind of amazed by how profound his impact on the world has been. So that the Gospels, and I guess the interpretation of his life through some of the New Testament writers, to me is really, really important.
Jesus went to the synagogue in Nazareth and he read a bit of the scriptures, and it said, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has chosen me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, and to set free the oppressed, and announce that the time has come when the Lord will save his people. And they were impressed with that, but then they were a bit upset because he explained it to them and said, you know, you're not looking in the right place, and you don't care for the poor and the oppressed. And the message is that is what we have to do. He didn't say go and read your Bible more and go to church more, sing more choruses. He said go out to the oppressed And when I was in England, I met a guy called Jim Punton. He used to come to the Mayflower Family Centre where we were youth working. And it was he who particularly pointed out to me that the Gospel of Luke, and all of us, in fact, who were there, was the gospel of the captives, and that it was the gospel that always points out that God brings justice to the poor and the oppressed, whereas the other gospels have different slant on things. So that's one of my favourite readings, because it reminds me of what I need to be doing, and it reminds me also that some of the people I've admired the most, be they Christians or others, like Gandhi or Mother Teresa, that's what they did, was they went and worked among the poor and worked for the uplifting of the poor.
Thank you. I didn't even consult with Jenny about how many minutes before 11 we... but I think I know... I said we might have questions from the floor, but my feeling is that if people would like to talk more with the panelees, maybe you could gather in a corner over there or something with a cup of coffee. And thank you all for your honesty, your depth of something, the depth of your responses and your experience, and for being prepared to share those with us. That's a very precious gift for us, and hopefully not too traumatic for you. If anybody would be interested in being on a panel like this somewhere further down the year, maybe you could mention that to Peter or me. A couple of people did mention it to me last time, and I think I've forgotten who. So if you've already mentioned it once, do mention it again. But thank you, and over to Jenny.